This episode of The Drunken Odyssey is brought to you by Scribophile, an online community with thousands of serious writers working in every conceivable genre. If you're eager to improve your own work and network with others, Scribophile is for you. Scribophile has educational tutorials, exciting forums, and most importantly, the ability to exchange in-depth critiques with other writers, using a karma system that keeps the exchange fair and equal. What is most exciting to me is that Scribophile allows writers to critique novel chapters, which is not something a writer can be guaranteed to experience in an MFA program. A basic account is free and grants you all the features, but upgrading to a premium account allows you to gain access to posting numerous works at once, requires no additional karma points to enter contests and other special features for only $9 a month or $65 a year. That's a lot less than a Netflix subscription. Listeners of The Drunken Odyssey will receive a 20% discount on top of those already low rates. Check out this week's show notes for details.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my friends, to episode 439 of the World's Greatest Writing Podcast. Or at least we're in the top 20. My guest today is the novelist Chuck Palahniuk, whose latest book, The Invention of Sound, is especially great. I command you to go buy a copy today. As an interviewer, I'm of two minds. On the one hand, I think that I'm good at what I do, which is to say, I'm a smart reader and writer, and so the chance to learn secrets about how writers create their books is exciting, and I feel like my listeners can learn as I do. And then there's me, a person who has a personal relationship to books, and sometimes, like today, I get to speak with a writer whose work I've known for years and end up having a personal conversation about that relationship with the author's books, with the author. I try not to force the serpent to devour its own tail or make authors somehow responsible for my feelings. At one point, Chuck and I discuss how a story must not seem didactic or have a political conclusion to clearly make, and as I edited this show, I am reminded of Anthony Burgess and how frustrated he was that A Clockwork Orange was his most famous work. He was frustrated, for one, because the book is famous as a corollary to the Stanley Kubrick film, but the frustration also stemmed from Clockwork being too didactic on the subject of social conditioning. If the stylized language wasn't so pyrotechnic, and if Alex's prerogatives of youth, as Burgess put it, didn't make him so outlandish, the didactic message would be difficult to overlook and forgive. Burgess is an underrated writer, dear listeners. One of my professors met Burgess and they discussed his frustration, and my professor said that he could sympathize with the intellectual dissatisfaction of having one's work culturally usurped by a film, to which Burgess reportedly retorted, "No, I'm pissed off." So the Drunken Odyssey secret headquarters is located in a condo development compound, and in the street, which is also a parking lot, I found a CD sans case on the pavement. It was called All the Best from Hawaii. I put it on a nearby hedge for the afternoon and evening in case the owner was missing it, but I also wondered if I might be its owner somehow. According to my iTunes, I have 9,063 albums, some of them being exotica and Hawaiian in nature. The next day, I put the CD in my car, since if I left the thing outside much longer, the CD would be destroyed. Now, All the Best from Hawaii is syrupy, gloopy, touristy music that is slickly produced, and despite its horribleness, it's really taken the edge off my anxiety running errands. I had to stop listening to the surf rock of my friends, the Intoxicators, since I end up driving like a surfer surfing, which is not good for a vehicle old enough to still have a CD player inside it. If you have any ideas about how I might give this CD back or gift it to someone in the universe who needs it more than I do, please email the scheme to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com. Or maybe I should just look out for more CDs on the street. Maybe someone is trying to tell me something. All right, a quick search of my iTunes has let me know that I didn't have All the Best from Hawaii before. I did have All the Best from Hawaii Volume 2, though. All right, let's get to the interview.
And now, the interview of the day.
My guest today is Chuck Palahniuk, who is, by my count, the author of 25 and a half books, including Fight Club, Invisible Monsters, Pygmy, Damned, and Invisible Monsters Remixed, hence the half book. Although now that I've taken a better look at it, I think it should be counted as a whole book. All right. I'm particularly enamored of his three most recent books, Adjustment Day, which imagines the dissolution of America from within due to prophecies and polemics of a strange voice from the internet. Consider This, a useful, companionable book containing lessons and stories about writing itself. And The Invention of Sound, his latest novel. The Invention of Sound tells the story of a man whose life is defined by his despair after the abduction of his daughter, a sorrow and an anger that leads him to scary places on the dark web, and a woman who continues her father's legacy of seeking after Foley screams so sublime they will cause all humans who hear the screams to sympathetically match the scream with even more horrible results. Thank you, Chuck, for giving me some time here.
Not at all. Thank you.
So, you know, one of the things that has struck me about your work is just how hard you work at it. And so consider this. I was really charmed by it. Partly it's got some tough love in there. And basically a lot of it is, yeah, just if you could not write, just do that, not write. But also, you know, what strikes me is, and you know, this is a notice I also had when looking at John Waters' writing is, you know, there is this urge to be transgressive and to gain attention, but I think you are careful about what you're trying to be transgressive about, but also you really put your shoulder into the writing so that the writing is great, so that you don't expect, I think, people to read your books if they're not great books first. Does that seem like a fair assessment that you're working your butt off on these books?
Yeah, very much so. You know, that's so much the minimalism that I was taught was that it starts with a sentence. And when I worked full-time at a job, it was just my goal every day was if I could just get one sentence that I was happy with every day, then it felt like my life was worth living. I had done something above and beyond just paying the bills every day.
A sentence that maybe felt resonant or that would stick.
You know, and I think that's why so many of the sentences are either A, stolen from somebody else, because so often that thing that is so brilliant and so perfectly worded is not your own. It's just the thing you overhear and that you admire. Scott Fitzgerald was famous for stealing every witty, clever, insightful thing that Zelda ever said, and he's kind of castigated for it now. But the other part is, I think that's why so many of my sentences have become memes and tattoos, is because they really encapsulate just one really succinct idea, and there's a little bit of poetry to them. Someone gave me a pillow that said, let me see, the things you own end up owning you. And she knit this herself. And it's that kind of sort of symmetrical poetry that makes these things very sticky in people's minds and makes them really appropriate for memes and tattoos. And so even if I just get one of those every day, I'd be perfectly happy.
And it probably requires generating a lot of stuff to find those moments where you're like, oh, that.
And it requires deleting, erasing, throwing away a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the glory part, is that I've got friends who are painters, and when they make a mistake, it's money down the drain. But when I make a mistake, it's just time down the drain.
A lot easier on the psyche, I think, and the fingers.
and the environment.
I also have to think that journalism maybe has something to do with this, at least in terms of having a respect for every word having to carry its weight.
Every word having to carry its weight, but also I think being trained at a school of journalism, we had a kind of an awareness of not using opinionated or pejorative language, that we couldn't use abstracts that betrayed our own opinion or our own prejudice about something. And so when I went into minimalism and Tom Spanbauer taught us about Recording Angel, it was just natural in that kind of fly on the wall perspective. I was trained not to use pejorative or abstract language, and everyone else struggled with that distinction forever. And nowadays you go to mainstream media and they don't hesitate to use loaded, abstract, pejorative language. So in a way, I feel like my fiction is way ahead of the game that way.
Well, I think because the rules of journalism has changed and the definition of journalism has changed.
And the goal of journalism, I think, has changed.
Well, you know, I'm very happy to be associated with Miami Book Fair as press, but also I was a bit surprised that they let me in the first year. Like, I didn't have a track record, and it's like, no, I've got a website. Okay, come on down. I'm like, okay. And it's not that I don't feel like I was worthy, but I wasn't sure they should figure out yet that I was worthy.
I'm going to be at the book fair this year, I guess, in a virtual way, like everybody else.
Yep. So I hope you have a great fair.
Thank you.
So one of the other things that just made me feel great about Consider This was just how much love you have for your mentors and how much gratitude you have for your mentors. And, you know, I went through NYU's MFA program and I wouldn't have traded it for the world, but a lot of it is just simply hints and notes that we've stolen from someone who stole it from someone or stole it for someone. And we try and keep track of who said it, because when we find something that really does help, it really just reduces so much of the extraneous confusion so that we can focus on the essence of the confusion and try and figure out a story to tell. And so I was really charmed at how well you did that and how heartfelt it seemed like all of these writers, including writers who, you know, if you look at their DNA as a writer and your DNA, like, it's not a straight line necessarily, which is probably one of the great things about being a writer, is how many places we learn from and who helps us grow.
There was a kind of sense of panic that struck me when Barry Hanna and Tom Jones and Catherine Dunn and Dennis Johnson and Ursula Le Guin and Nora Ephron all died very quickly within this very short stretch of a couple of years. And it panicked me, thinking, you know, so many of the people that I really admired are gone. And I really want to put these notes down on paper and, in a way, record everyone's best advice and everyone's wonderful anecdote and their really useful trick. Because, you know, if somebody didn't stop and do it, it didn't seem like it was getting done.
Well, it was just the perfect, you know, I read a lot of those kind of books, you know, for this podcast, and a co-host of mine, Vanessa Blakesley, we discussed You're a Stranger Than Fiction, even though it's not directly a writing book, but we didn't have a writing book by you at the time. So we decided to cover it, and it was a great episode. But yeah, a lot of these books are kind of interchangeable, and I kind of don't mind as long as I pick out one or two things, even if I already know them, like, okay, to remember them in a vivid way, like, that's good enough. But Consider This, it really dusted my whole brain off, which I really, really needed. So it's like near at the top of my list of, okay, if you're going to have to get one of those books, like, you're not going to go to an MFA or not this year, and you kind of want to, you know, get in there, like, Consider This is one of the best.
Now, the first workshop I was ever in, the book that we were all told to get and to read was John Gardner's, is it On Writing? No, that's Stephen King's book. It's called Writing Fiction, or
The Craft of Fiction, I want to say.
The Craft of Fiction, yes. And the Gardner book was filled with such really highbrow references. Mm-hmm. And we never discussed it in the workshop, and no one ever referred to it. And I wondered why we had all been asked to read it, because it was never applied or used. And so in a way, I really wanted to write a useful book that would have a lot of lowbrow references, that applied and demonstrate how each technique was being used in very popular 20th century fiction.
And it's very readable in and of itself, which is also, I think, a requirement of one of those books where the John Gardner, it's great in some ways. I just remember how absurdly critical and angry he was at metafiction. And I can appreciate probably his exasperation in that particular moment in literary history. But considering like the avalanche of what has happened with postmodernism since, like, it comes off as really quaint, I think.
Now, was he writing that as a contemporary of Gaddis and Pynchon? Is that what he was reacting to?
Yeah, I think
to?
It was the early to mid-70s, I think, is when The Craft of Fiction comes out. And it's, of course, to upstart young writers, this is going to shake up the establishment. Like, of course, I'm going to mimic that. And so I imagine in the 90s, so many writing teachers had to deal with everyone who thought they were going to be David Foster Wallace or you, that they maybe had their hands full with that. And so, and then the moment passes and then it's like, oh yeah, right. David Foster Wallace, there's plenty to learn from. But yeah, it's important not to make it a religion, I think, as a writer, because you need to build your own.
Yeah. And yeah, it's always sad to mention David.
Yeah.
A million years ago when Fight Club first came out in Italian, there was this very famous, she was a translator and critic named Fernanda Paivano. And she was the woman who had brought and translated Hemingway and Steinbeck and Faulkner, you know, all these American writers, and introduced them to Italian culture. And she really was the leading Italian literary authority. And she did this fantastic piece about Fight Club, in which she said the future of American literature is going to be David Foster Wallace and Chuck Palahniuk. And I was always just really stunned by that. And then when David died, I saw that he and I had been born on exactly the same day, February 21st, 1962. And I was really stunned by that. And, you know, I'm always going to miss the fact that David is not here doing this job.
Yeah. Well, his posthumous novel, like, it's on my shelf and I can't bring myself to read it because I need to believe there's at least one more out there. And so I don't know when the right time is going to be to read it, but so far I haven't found the right time.
So, lighten things up now.
Well, you know, one of the things that I really loved about The Invention of Sound is there is both this nostalgia and cynicism about old-time Hollywood and an interest in how movies get made. And so you really made Foley work, which is a difficult thing. You know, you can't make noises, technically. You can try and make the reader make noises, but you can't make noises in a novel. And so you have to convey the science of sound, but also how sound works on the body in fiction. And I thought that you did that really well. So was that something you were confident about early on, or did that take a while to figure out, like, okay, no, I can make a book out of this concept and be able to deliver it?
Well, so much of that is, if you can't use pejorative fiction and you can't dictate the physical emotional reaction, you can't tell the reader, oh, this is the scary part, or suddenly a terrifying noise broke out. Suddenly, all the horror was apparent, and that terrific over-the-top Lovecraft way. You can't do that in minimalism. You can't dictate emotional state or emotional reaction. So you look at the things you can do, and one is to go on the body, to describe the physical reaction, either of the point of view character or of someone else who's present, describe just what their body does and how that communicates the emotional state without having to say it outright.
That's half of the book. And the other book is, there's kind of two to three main characters, depending on how we regard it. And also, it kind of works like a play in that, you know, all these Chekhovian pieces, like, we don't know how they all fit, but they're all going to fit before the end. Can you talk a little bit about Gates Foster and that story and what maybe inspired you to think about some of the really dark evil that's out there?
There's a kind of tried and true technique, and that is a dead child automatically signals drama. If there's a dead child or a missing child, this is going to be something very dramatic and is never going to have the kind of broad lightness of comedy. But if there's a dead parent, then it signals it's going to be comedy. And if you look at most of the television of my lifetime, it centers around a dead parent that is missing and that can't be resolved. And the children don't really react to it. You know, the Partridge Family, they never sat around and said, "Oh, do you miss Dad? Dad's dead." One Day at a Time, they never sat around and said, "Do you miss Dad? Dad's dead. And Alice doesn't live here anymore." They never really sit around and say, "Do you miss Dad? No, Dad was a son of a bitch." Comedy is always about a dead parent and seeing children, primarily children, move forward, but children and women. A lot of times, children and men. Courtship of Eddie's Father, Family Affair with Sebastian Cabot, it's children and men. But you always see these vulnerable characters moving forward very boldly, despite this huge, tragic, unresolvable thing in the background. So with Gates Foster, he hasn't seen his daughter in 17 years. She disappeared when she was 8. And the only time he sees her is when he opens the dairy case at the supermarket and he sees the age-progressed depiction of her on the side of a milk carton or something. And so he has started this campaign to explore the dark web because he might not be able to find her. But if he can find a man in any kind of a photograph or video with her, then he might be able to find the man who destroyed her or abducted her. And so his mission, you know, joining at Media Ray, is to find any kind of trace of who did whatever happened to his daughter. And so, of course, it's drama. There was an analogy that really broke my friend Amy Hempel. She does enormous amounts of fantastic animal rescue work. And her heart was broken when she read my analogy that when they look for animals to use in product testing or scientific experiments, a lot of times, well, they'll look for former house pets because former house pets were raised with love and they will always try to please whoever has custody of them. And they will tolerate an enormous amount of pain and suffering without lashing out, where strays picked up on the street have a survival instinct. And if you try to product test or do some sort of medical experiment on them, they will try to destroy you. And so Gates Foster is hoping that since his daughter was raised with so much love, that she might have been able to tolerate an enormous amount of torture and suffering, and she might in some way still be alive because she had that tolerance that a dog or a cat, you know, had being raised by people who loved it. That made Amy cry like crazy. That killed her.
Part of the premise on the other side is also the way dogs respond to sirens and this sort of need to sympathetically join the noise around you, which in a vague sense is definitely a metaphor for America right now, but in a specific sense leads down the science of hearing. So there's two examples of your understanding of dogs enhancing your ability to imagine, you know, the human condition in, you know, a little more nuanced way. I think we underrate how we are in the continuum of the animal world rather than being completely above it or separate from it.
So much of my life, there were periodically these anthropomorphized animal novels that were huge successes. There was Jonathan Livingston Seagull. There was Watership Down, Secrets of the Rats of Nim. There were, you know, book after book that people bought by the millions, in which animals basically acted as people and were very relatable because of that. I think that there's a dynamic functioning there where if you can make the reader feel more or less superior to the characters, then the reader will have a great deal more empathy and sympathy and nurturance for the character. My favorite example is the first page of Gone with the Wind. What is the first thing that Scarlett O'Hara says?
I know it's in the Consider This, but I don't remember.
It is, she says, war, war, war. There is not going to be any war. And as soon as she says that, we think, you poor, dumb girl. And despite her social privilege and her charm and all of these advantages, we feel superior to her and we instantly care for her because we know that she's heading for a disaster. And I think that there's a subtle similar thing happening with animal narratives, because as human beings, we feel superior to rabbits or seagulls. And so we let our guard down and we're more emotionally involved with them than we would be with another human being.
In Cujo, Stephen King has like a 3-page bit where it's Cujo's point of view. It's a close third on the dog. And I don't remember most of the book, and the horrible part I don't remember, but I cannot forget the bit where he went into the mind of the dog. And I'm like, I'm the dog. Reading it, I am the dog. And it didn't feel as strange as it maybe should have.
That's when the dog gets bit by the bat, right?
I think so. Yeah. Like, I think it's kind of going about its dog day. And then at the end of that, I think that's when, yeah, the rabies incident happens. So I made the mistake of looking at reviews of Adjustment Day.
And, oh, please. I didn't make that mistake.
Well, Adjustment Day is one of my favorite books. And all right, what infuriated me about the reviews is partly, I think there's the book people want to have read and they don't really, you know, what was it? Henry James says you have to give everyone his Don A. Like, whatever your idea is, like that's what you judge it on, not what you think you wanted or whatever. It's not like ordering a cheeseburger at a restaurant and they didn't put the ingredients right or, you know, overcooked it. But, you know, I want to make a few observations and see what your thoughts are. Although if you don't want to talk about it, that's fine. But one, you know, it seemed like one of your most ambitious books, and the way the plot worked was really complex. And there were a lot of storylines. And normally I feel like your books are very warm, maybe hot. The characters, whatever the intensity is, and the voice of this book, and maybe partly it's because of, you know, so much of the political discourse of the mysterious Talbot Reynolds, but I felt like, you know, it was this giant mesmeric kind of postmodern epic. Like, it's not a systems novel because it's about the dissolution of a system. Maybe it's the creation of a new system, but I just found it conceptually like one of the, I can't remember the last time I fell into a book the way I fell into Adjustment Day. And I think what people were overlooking is you actually examining the discourse of conspiracy anarchists, and instead of just treating it like, oh yes, isn't it silly, I am satirizing this, like I don't know that you were satirizing it rather than exploring it. So does any of that make sense?
Yeah, I talked to at least one person, typically a bunch of people from each of the different points of view, and I really wanted to kind of honor their point of view, but also kind of push it to the extent of where it would start to fall apart. Because so many of my novels are like what we used to do at the Freightliner Trucks where I worked, where we would put every component in a laboratory setting, and we would run the windshield wipers for 100 million hours until they would start to break apart. And we would study why they broke apart, what aspect of them, what element failed. And so often with books beginning with Fight Club, it's about starting a little machine and then running it faster and faster and longer, and then analyzing what fails first. And so much of Adjustment Day was also about dramatizing what's described by the German anthropologist Gunnar Heinzen. He had a fantastic book called Sonnen und Weltmacht, Sons and World Power, that does a very fantastic case of demonstrating how excess secondary sons, second, third, fourth sons in educated families, generally, once that they reach a certain surplus, that's what generates enormous social revolution, because educated sons expect a place in the world automatically. that typically only first sons get. So when there aren't enough places of status for them, then the secondary sons, they go out to the world, like the Spanish explorers. They were the more or less the cause of the French Revolution. It's this sort of surplus of sons, educated sons with high expectations, which you could say are the incels right now. It's that surge of unhappy male energy that causes big social change. And so I just wanted to dramatize that in the way that so many of my other books have dramatized the work of the British anthropologist, Victor Turner. In a way, I'm running the little machine to study it. And I'm also kind of dramatizing a social theory that's been put down by somebody else.
And telling a damn good story. So was it difficult to outline and plot the story?
You know, I never plot books through the end of the second act. I always plot to what I can foresee as the mechanical breakdown of the plot. Now, Fight Club is based on a violation of the social contract, that this man has gone to support groups and allowed people to think that he is dying of what they're dying of. And that violation, that deception, ends at the moment when they go back there and the female protagonist says he's not dying of anything. And they expose each other and are suddenly placed in this position of humiliation and subjugation to the people that they were deceiving. And so that is the mechanical breakdown at the end of the second act. And everything beyond that has to surprise me, because if it doesn't, it's not going to surprise anybody else. And that's really why I write, is to see how the story completes itself in the third act.
But Adjustment Day, the first two acts, like, it just seemed like it was a lot more complicated than in most of your books. I just feel like no matter how strange the characters or how different they might be from me, partly it's the way that you write, and I just end up feeling so close to so many of these characters, and it's really intimate. And with Adjustment Day, there was a little bit more distance, which normally, like, that's a red flag for me. Like, okay. And instead, like, I fell into the book. Partly, I guess I'm asking, why am I obsessed with this book? Which is not something that you could answer, and I probably need to pay someone like $150 to help me talk through. But the complexity of just how many moving parts, how many characters, how many in this, you know, imagined contemporary American history, you know, I would love to know just a little bit of insight, like in the first two acts, like in just imagining all the pieces that you were putting, you know, on the table for this story. Could you talk a little bit about that process?
The first two acts are basically establishing the three nation states. And then the third act, the surprising act, is what is going to be the internal flaw in each of these nation states that will ultimately kind of, you know, shake it apart. But there was another thing I wanted to demonstrate is Gunnar Heinsohn. He said as part of his Sons and World Power theory, he says that every one of these surplus son revolutions has a text that becomes so commonplace that it loses all value. And it typically doesn't really have a lot of meaning to it. It is kind of sound and fury, but signifying nothing. And his examples were Mein Kampf. His examples were Mao's Little Red Book. That they're texts that people can carry with them. They're reproduced in such vast numbers that they have no value anymore. For the Spanish explorers, it was the Bible. God bless. But the Bible was the text that justified everything in a way, the text that could never be fully understood. So there had to be a kind of density and obtuseness to Adjustment Day, because it was supposed to function like those texts that Gunnar Heinsohn cited for all these previous revolutions.
It could be Dada poetry, or it could be profound political insight.
Yeah. And you take from it what you take from it, because it's supposed to just justify what you plan to do anyway.
So something that you discussed in Consider This, I don't want to say gave me a panic, but a bookseller, right when you were promoting Fight Club, a bookseller told you, he basically gave you the 16-month rule. As a writer, you have to produce a book every 16 months or the public will forget. They will fail to look forward to a book of yours if they have to wait too long. And so I think I'm at month 17 for my book. And although I note it took you a little bit to get to the second book, can you talk a little bit about that rule and maybe how it influences the way that you look at, you know, future projects and just what happens when you go to write most days?
There's some really unpleasant truths about writing and publishing that I feel very conflicted, because if I had heard them really early as a beginning writer, they might have really dissuaded me from writing. And if that was the case, then my life would never have really been focused around any sort of vision. My life would have just been about paying the bills and kind of following the rules and never really amounting to anything. But Bob Mall, who ran 23rd Avenue Books, he told me that thing about you've got to have a book out at least every 18 months or, you know, people lose interest. They find another writer to read. And that hasn't always been the case. This year I had 3 books out. So in the shadow of COVID, I think it might take people 3 years to read these 3 books. So I've got a little bit of breathing room here that did very much panic me at the time. I know a lot of writers. Well, Doug Copeland, who wrote Generation X, he told me once that he wished that his early editors had been much more rigorous with him, because he felt that after Generation X, people were very nervous about changing his text or editing him too heavily. And he felt like he'd be a much better writer and those would be better books if people had really been much more vigorous with him.
Were they afraid of slowing down the process, or was it more a matter of he's a property and we need to just not interfere with whatever that makes that property work?
Right. He's so revered that we're not going to touch a word of it. And part of me wishes that I'd had, you know, my first advances were so small that it was really difficult to try to live from year to year on that little money. And so that was a factor in getting those books out. So I can't regret it. You know, it was just part of the circumstances.
So mostly negative then, the drive to get the next book out.
A little negative, but also, you know, it kept me in community. Every week I met in the same workshop with the same people, and workshops where people meet once a month, those writers don't get very much done. But workshops where they meet every week, those writers really crank it out. And so I was in there with writers like Chelsea Kane, who was also getting a thriller out every year. And that's how you really build a readership. So it kept me in community during a time when I might have been isolated.
One of the things that I admire about your writing is you feel like you owe the reader a good story. And part of it also involves surprising yourself and satisfying yourself. Like, in order to give the reader enough surprises, it has to be surprising for you. And that's something that you have to do regularly, which sounds like a plan, but it's not something you can plan for. Can you talk a little bit about that paradox? And is it just a matter of doing the work until the great thing happens?
See, that is the aspect of it that is so frightening every time you start a new project. It's not just about solving a problem. You have to create the problem and you have to solve the problem. And the problem itself is the more important thing. That's something that Ira Levin had told me. He said, coming up with a really compelling, unique problem is 90% of writing. Mm-hmm. You know, solving the problem is solving the problem. But imagine going to a job every day where you don't know what the job is and you don't know how to do it. Every day you have to reinvent the job completely and then you have to do it. And it's that uncertainty that is so maddening. And I think that's why so many writers drink, because you are responsible for messing things up and cleaning things up. And you've got to do it in a very compelling, interesting way. And I think that's another reason why I never really finish a book until I get the idea for the next book, because that way I'm never fully out there with nothing.
Kind of the way Hemingway liked to finish his day of writing in the middle of a sentence, rather than having polished off something and then have to get up in the morning to face the typewriter again.
That's what my dad always said. He said, never dump the one you're with until you're dating the next one. And so that, you know, because you've got to go on tour and you've got to be this completely different person, this marketing person, and that can make you hate the process so much that unless you're really deeply in love with the next idea, you would never go back and write another book. You would hate it so much.
Well, you're one of the reasons why I've grown to admire Ira Levin so much, even though I'm a little bit younger than you. So growing up, like his products, a lot of them weren't brand new. And if they were, I was still kind of too young to like Death Trap, like I was 11 when that movie came out. But by the time I was in grad school, it kind of occurred to me like, oh, I've kind of accidentally filtered in all of this Ira Levin. And even though I haven't been doing the math, it turns out it's all great. And he has this miraculous knack for figuring out what was bothering America and what our anxieties were, especially the anxieties we were not willing to talk about or think about, and managed to get us to talk and think about it without actually directly addressing what the actual thing was, but by finding that they're kind of allegories, even though they're realistic in their own right, which is how I think an allegory has to work today.
You know, and they allow us to approach a topic that is so emotionally loaded that we have no freedom around it. We can't even discuss it. We can't even recognize it. But if we can craft it, present it in this fictional kind of absurd thing, we're going to turn your wives into beautiful robots. You know, Stepford Wives depicted the backlash against feminism 20 years before Susan Faludi wrote Backlash and won the Pulitzer Prize for it. But it allowed us to look at this pushback against feminism in a comic, dramatic way that made it palatable. And we could talk about it without talking about the actual thing. We could have a kind of an emotional, develop an emotional callus to it, a distance to it, where we could eventually recognize it as what it actually was. I think that, you know, so much of Rosemary's Baby was about reproductive health and the inability to control reproductive health. And to put a really fine point on it, the fact that a lot of women had trusted their doctors and taken thalidomide and had monsters, because that is how Rosemary reacts to the baby. She says, what have you done to its hands? What have you done to its feet? And other characters are saying, look at its feet. Look at its hands. They're little claws. And Ira Levin could never publicly say, I wrote a novel about the horrors of thalidomide, because he would never want to be thought of as exploiting that tragedy. But he gave us this emotional way of looking at it through a metaphor and expressing all of the horror and all the grief of that situation.
Well, and if someone has a political point they want to make, probably write an essay or run for office, right? If you're presenting a novel, you have to tell someone a story, and that story has to work. And if there are politics in it, I think it helps if it's not a simple political message, but also it needs to be emotional more than it needs to be, huh, okay, now I've changed my opinion on this political matter.
Emotional and also not didactic. It needs to be porous enough that people can relate and sympathize with the characters regardless of their own experience. And that's how you get under the radar and you kind of coach people to consider a different viewpoint. You can't dictate that.
And I think that's, you know, a lesson that you've brought to your own work.
You know, the trick is never to get caught. You never want to get caught dictating the secret thing, because then you're just being boring.
I mean, you know, like the places where it might seem you're doing it, it's more like here's an unreliable narrator with a wild political opinion. And you can think about it, but it's not like this is the opinion of the book and you should just accept this.
Right. You want people to enjoy it on a bunch of different levels and come back to it several times throughout their lifetime and eventually maybe have a full understanding of it. But first and foremost, it should be a diversion, because people, they don't read because they're popular. They read because in that moment they're alone, they're probably stressed, they need to calm down, they're isolated. And so if you can give them something in that moment that's a comfort and a distraction to get them through that moment, then, you know, people, if they had a party to go to, they would not be reading a book.
Well, it depends on the party, but yeah. And also something to focus on, right? I mean, you know, I think of David Foster Wallace's This Is Water speech, where, you know, that's one of the things a good book really has to do for us, is really help us focus on something, which may be the most hard thing to do in postmodern life, is just, let me try and focus on one thing, one story, one person, one thought, just not be crowded out by so many different things with pop-up windows and advertisements and family. Like, I just, my brain has to go somewhere. And so I just admire your craft so much in that, and I realize this comes from partly the desire to sell books and keep selling books, but it's also just this very pragmatic, like, if I don't want someone to pick up the book and go, yeah, this is fairly all right, I can sit with this perhaps while I drink. Like, no, like, you want them to pick it up, and then you want them to feel disappointed if they have to put it down before they're done.
So often, so many of my favorite books are books that I picked up, I started to read, and I put them down and I said, no, I'm not going to read this. But they were so compelling that eventually I had to pick them back up. I was that way with Jesus' Son. I read the first story and I did not finish the book for 5 years. And then I read the book every 6 months after that for the rest of my life. You know, that taste changes across time. And this is what I try to teach my students, mm-hmm. is that the goal is not to be liked. If you are liked, you will be forgotten tomorrow. The goal is to be remembered, because taste changes across time, and eventually taste will change and accept you. And at that point, you really have legs, because your work's been out there for a long time and it's taken people 10 years to really embrace it. But at least it wasn't sort of, do you know who the biggest author of the 1950s was? Biggest fiction author?
If I guessed, I'm pretty sure I would get it wrong.
If I told you Auntie Mame, Patrick Dennis, the guy who was the fictionalized foundling that was given over to Auntie Mame in the Auntie Mame plays and movies, Patrick Dennis wrote maybe a half dozen books about his relationship, his growing up with his Aunt Mame. They were all novels. They were all massive sellers, huge sellers. And they have, you know, they have a public awareness because they were made into movies and to Broadway musicals. But by the end of his career, he was selling so little that he ended up becoming the butler to Ray and Joan Kroc of McDonald's. So Patrick Dennis basically ended his days as the butler for the McDonald's tycoon. And that's what happens if you are embraced too readily, is that you are forgotten just as readily.
One of my addictions are library book sales.
Yeah.
I cannot resist a library book sale. And partly, you know, a brand new bookstore, it's like, okay, here's what the publishers want me to have. And because I'm a podcaster, like, books just show up. Like, every single, like, books show up.
Yeah.
And before I could even think, what do I like? What am I, like, they just keep coming through the door. But the friends of the library bookstore, it's like, okay, there are no obligations in there. Like, let's just go see what's in there. And yeah, you can sort of see certain books keep coming up, like, oh, that's what was popular in the 80s, and the books are still here, and nobody wants them. And back in the 70s, and you can kind of track, like, okay, yeah, because they publish so many, like, they end up over and over again in these Friends of the Library book sales. And it is kind of interesting anthropological work. And sometimes I find books that, yeah, I just wonder, why wasn't this a bigger book? Because this just seems like one of the best books I've ever read. But that's just because anything with a weird enough cover, and it's like, okay, does it pass the first page test?
A lot of times these, I'm thinking of, I believe her last name was Siddons, a Southern writer who wrote The House Next Door, which is considered one of the finest haunted house novels ever written. And it's just revered, but very few people know about it, because she spent her entire career writing these kind of Southern lady society novels, these very kind of Barbara Taylor Bradford novels. And then just out of the blue one day, she wrote this horror novel about a contemporary house that's being built in this neighborhood and how it destroys everyone who lives in it. And maybe because the rest of her books were so forgotten, but very few people know about The House Next Door, because it was more or less a one of.
And it didn't fit the brand.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Before I forget, I just saw a video of, you know, right now, real time, in Louisville, Kentucky, that Carmichael's bookstore looks like it is about to get attacked and possibly burned and looted. And so my prayers go out to the people at Carmichael's, because they've always treated me fantastically well. And in 2016, I did a 16-hour signing at Carmichael's, and they fed me pizza and they kept the line going for 16 hours. And it was a grueling day, but I hope Carmichael's makes it through tonight. I really do.
Louisville, Kentucky. People. So it seems like sometimes people want political answers from you about what's happening, you know, in the world today. And also, I think people, you know, you've written about this sometimes where you're given offers from Hollywood to do dubious things. And sometimes it's not even a matter of selling out exactly, but they want your sense of anarchy to help sell something, which is either postmodernly very funny or just in this infinite regression. Can you talk a little bit about the way that you manage your brand? I know you wrote about it in Consider This, and the sort of flowcharts that you go through to try and figure out, okay, what are the ethics here and what do I want to do? And how much do I have to think about how my work and how I myself am being framed or attempted to be framed by these companies?
You know, I always go back to Michel Foucault, the French postmodernist, and Foucault's idea that no matter where you throw your influence, you're going to strengthen the other side. So if you kind of back one side, you're backing both sides in different ways. And so I've always thought that the most effective thing is try to present an alternative that's more or less free from either of these binary options, which is a Derrida idea that everything in Western culture is either this or that, and it has to be either this or that. And so my goal is always to try to present a third option that is neither this nor that, and to make it so appealing that people will adopt it because it might serve them better. That's why I was such a huge member of Cacophony Society, because they were constantly throwing out these experiential experiments like Burning Man. And the ones that really served people without an agenda, without selling something, that allowed people a forum, a place to express themselves and be crazy, those are the things like Burning Man that have lasted for decades. One of my favorite examples is I was in Italy and my Italian editor was telling me that the Italian fur industry in, I think it was the 80s, decided they really wanted to broaden the market for fur. And so they started to sell fur on the installment plan to middle class and lower class people. That you could take out a loan, a mortgage, to buy a fur coat like a movie star. And so people so admired the celebrities who had furs that poor people took out loans and they bought furs. And suddenly everyone was wearing furs, and the celebrities saw poor people wearing fur. So celebrities instantly dropped fur entirely. And once poor people saw rich people drop fur, the poor people all turned their mink coats in like a foreclosed house. They just quit claimed their fur coats. And the entire Italian fur industry was destroyed. And it was destroyed without any work from PETA. It was destroyed without any picketing. There wasn't any kind of protest or releasing minks or throwing a dead raccoon on Anna Wintour's lunch plate at the Four Seasons. There was no direct political action taken. And that's what I think that good writing or any kind of good creative work is about presenting alternatives that don't necessarily dictate do this or don't do this, but they offer an option that is more attractive than what's already in place. I could go on and on. There's so many examples of this. People think that fashion doesn't count, but the fact that people switch from silk top hats from beaver top hats are what saved the beaver in North America. If we hadn't switched to silk top hats, the beaver would be extinct in Canada and the United States. And now the beaver is an enormous problem. And it's because fashion dictated, not beaver.
Well, and the Davy Crockett craze, what, threatened raccoon populations. when suddenly, like, we need 10 million hats, like, now.
And these things aren't resolved. because of a lot of protests, they're resolved because somebody presents an alternative and models it and makes it more useful and attractive and a more effective status indicator than the old model.
We evolve.
And that's my job. So I don't want my job to be supporting this side or that side. My job is to try to present a third side.
I love the recent books. Like I said, the last three books, like they've made a deep impression on me. And I don't think I'm jaded, but I do think, yeah, like I'm the processor of my brain is, you know, working harder than maybe it should these days. But I would like to point out that in my history with your work, there was Fight Club, and I'm like, I think I'm in. Like, this is great. I think I'm in. And I read Invisible Monsters, and it was one of those cases where I was so in love with the book until I wasn't, and then I was furious. And it's when one of the plot twists comes out, and it's a plot twist that the narrator herself had simply been withholding from the audience, or at least that's how I interpreted it at the time. And I was furious, and I'm not even sure why I was furious, because I wasn't necessarily even a you must respect plot. Like, I was a little bit looser about that. I was a little bit more postmodern at the time. But I finished the book, which is a testament to something, and I didn't sell the book. The sheets are not completely acid free, like, they're a little bit yellow. And I've been exploring Invisible Monsters Remixed, which I'm beginning to remember why I love that book so much, on this like insane picaresque adventure with these three people, very damaged people in an American landscape that is probably just as damaged but doesn't know it or can't think about it. And the way that you've reimagined the project, and I'm kind of doing the audiobook, so it's also constrained in that strange way, but the way that you structured that book, the Remix, was to try and take away the math that we do when we're reading through a story and we know, okay, there's like 20 pages left, there's 10 pages left. And because of the way that the person has to navigate through the book, they aren't allowed to do that. And it also allows for all of these other dislocations to happen in the reading experience. If you want to discuss it, that's great. But I also want to tell you that the one book of yours that kind of made me really angry and I felt like you violated the contract with the reader is winning me over again in the Remix. And I do want to go back and reread the original Invisible Monsters. And of course, I couldn't have gotten so mad if I weren't so in love with the book in the first place, where I kind of felt like, even though I'm not like these people, I felt like I was on that trip with them. So I have this very complicated relationship with that book. And I do want to apologize for letting that book make me mad at you for a few years before I gave more of your books a chance. I've read about 9 or 10 of them. And so all of the ones that I've read are really great, and they're all different. You know, like, you're not simply doing theme and variation. Even if most of your work is fairly transgressive, it's not one note of transgression. But I've had this really kind of complicated relationship with Invisible Monsters. And I think, owe you an apology for maybe reacting too strongly to the one bit that made me mad, because your work has been consistently great over the years. So I apologize for that, even though this is what one person buying your books that, like, I don't know that you could track that, but anyway.
No, I had this really sweet anecdote about Monsters, and that was a book I started writing when I was in my late 20s. So it was really a book I was cutting my teeth on, but it was really the book that I wrote thinking in complete resignation that I was never going to get published. One night I was driving through the desert, and I stopped at this all-night gas station in the middle of nowhere, and there was this kid pumping gas. In Oregon, you can't pump your own gas, so they have to have somebody pumping gas 24 hours a day. And he came over, and he was reading a paperback book. He put the book down on top of the gas pump. He came over, he pumped the gas, I paid, and he went back. He picked up his book, and I saw that at 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, in the middle of this windswept desert, in the middle of nowhere, this kid was reading Invisible Monsters. And I thought, that is so much why I write, is that, you know, that you can, in people in whatever circumstances are, of isolation or stress or crowded airplanes or a horrible noisy airports or emergency rooms,
chronic pain.
Or so many people in, what's that?
Chronic pain.
People in chemotherapy wards, yeah. Chemo lounges, people have books in all of these places that are really, by their nature, unhappy places. And part of me thought, you know, I should tell that kid, you know, I wrote that book. You want me to sign it? And I thought, no, I'm just not going to get between him and the book. I'm not going to put myself in there as this thing in between. He's in the book. He's enjoying the book, I hope. The book is a comfort. And I felt so good. And I always think about that kid in the middle of the night reading that book.
It meant a lot to me. And I feel like the remix, which is your attempt to make it as experimental as you wanted, right, when it first came out.
Right. Well, that was the original book I wanted to write.
And are you happy with the way that the experiment turned out?
I am. In fact, I'm happier than I would have been if it had been written that way in the first place, because the things I was able to put into it were autobiographical as well as kind of absurd and over the top, because I really did want to make it as much like the experience of reading a big fat Vogue magazine, the September issue of Vogue, where you're never sure where you're at because the pages are so misnumbered and you're always being jumped around physically within the magazine. And so in a way, you never have a sense of fully knowing the magazine because you've never gone through it in a very linear way.
There's no way to go through it in a linear way.
Exactly. And it's so thick. It's so unknowable. It's full of so many tantalizing little details. And so the remix made it what I wanted it to be in the first place, that Vogue magazine.
And a little bit more maturity as a writer maybe helped you finish that task.
That and a lot of kind of, there's a little bit of consider this nostalgia in there, that kind of sense that the world in which I wrote this book no longer exists. I'm writing about a time that no longer exists. I'm writing about friends that are dead. I'm writing about me. I'm writing about a 27-year-old me that is now twice that age. So there's everything. There's also has to be a sense of loss in there with all the kind of fun. And maybe, you know, like the dead parent in comedy, there has to be that sense of unacknowledged tragedy that heightens the comedy.
I think it's what makes it so human, that it's not simply a lark or, hey, look at all the crazy things I can do, which, I don't know, if you're smart and you're 17, you can probably pull that off randomly, but to have it attached to a great story, it's really beautiful work, and I'm enjoying returning to the material a little bit more mature myself than when I read it the first time in my 20s.
Thank you.
Well, that is the show for this week. I would like to thank Scribophile and Chuck Palahniuk. Don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including Comics Are Trying to Break Your Heart by Drew Barth and The Curator of Schlock by Jeff Schuster. All right, gang, until next week, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
Dear listeners, writers, and fellow Odysseans, send your questions, observations, complaints, manifestos, transcriptions of Turkish opera, and whatever else you got to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com.
Dear listeners, this is your friend, Chris Booth. If you have enjoyed this program, which comes to you absolutely free, and are wondering what you might do to support this show, please, please, please write a review of the podcast on iTunes, comment on the website, and most of all, tell your friends. If you buy books online, please click on the Powell's link on the left-hand side of the website. Doing so will grant this show a small commission on anything you purchase, at no expense at all to you, and help support both a wonderful podcast and a wonderful brick-and-mortar independent bookstore in Portland, Oregon. If you must use the services of the metastasizing mega-corporate empire Amazon.com, then there is a similar link to Amazon further down the page on the left-hand side. You fiends. Thank you for listening. I will now resume drinking. Ever yours, Christopher.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.